Hare Krishna. So today we continue with our discussion on the Ishopanishad. Till now we have discussed the introduction of the Ishopanishad in our first class, in which we discussed a broad overview of the Vedic literature, the presentation of Srila Prabhupada as a progression in that Vedic literature from Vedic, Bhagavad Gita, Vaishnava, Srimad Bhagavatam, and Gaudiya Vaishnava, Chaitanya Charitamrita, the Nectar of Devotion. And we discussed the position of the four books, how they give us an understanding of the sadhya and sadhana. And then in the introduction, we discuss further about the Vedas, how they progressively lead to the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna. Now we will start with the invocation. Now technically speaking, the invocation is not a part of the Ishopanishad. The invocation is actually a standard Vedic saying which is spoken on various occasions. It conveys a very profound truth that is very consistent with the theme of the Ishopanishad, especially its first three verses, starting from Ishavasyam. And Srila Prabhupada very aptly positions it before Ishavasyam in his book. Now, Ishopanishad was not written as a book by Srila Prabhupada directly. Srila Prabhupada wrote it as a series of articles in his Back to Godhead magazines, which he had published prior to establishing the Krishna consciousness movement. The Back to Godhead magazine was started by Srila Prabhupada in 1944, when at the peak of the Second World War, Srila Prabhupada felt that sharing the knowledge of God was the best way to attack the problem of violence and conflict at its root. So from that time, Srila Prabhupada struggled and maintained it for many years. And then after he went to America, he started Back to Godhead with his disciples taking primary responsibility for it. So when Srila Prabhupada was running Back to Godhead, at that time, he wrote a series of articles which were purports on the Ishopanishad verses. And those were later compiled by his disciples and made into the Ishopanishad book. So today we will discuss about the invocation of the Ishopanishad. So let's start with the verse. So the verse is Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. So this sounds very sweet and enigmatic. Om Purnamada. So Adaha is this here. This whatever is here, it's Purna. Om Purnamada Purnamidam. Adha is this, not in terms of proximity, but this in terms of what is being primarily referred to. So that which is the object of meditation, object of contemplation, object of discussion, that is Purna. And Purnamidam, what is here, this is also Purna. Then Purna Purnamudachyate, that from that complete, this complete has come out. And the wonderful thing about that complete is Purnasya Purnamadaya, that even when the completes come out from the complete, still Purnameva Vashishyate, the Purna remains complete in and of itself. So this is almost a mystical address or glorification of the Absolute Truth. That the Absolute Truth is complete, this world is complete. That Absolute Truth is the source of this world. So because this world has come from the complete, so it is complete. But because that Absolute Truth is complete, so therefore, though so many complete units come from it, it remains the complete whole. So what is this actually talking about? The verse itself does not tell us what is this Purna thing. Adaha, Idam, what are these pronouns referring to? In English we have pronouns he, she, it, they, there. So they are obviously referring to someone, either male, female or a group of people. But what is that being referred to is not directly stated in this verse. And this is typical of the style of the Upanishads. The Upanishads are enigmatic. Enigmatic means puzzling. They are primarily meant for intellectuals who love to speculate. So if things are given very straight and easy to intellectuals, they don't like it. They need to have things presented with great sophistication and have some stuff which makes them stretch their minds. So the Upanishads cater to that need while also leading these intellectuals towards the ultimate truth. So what is this complaint? To understand this, we can use the concept of infinity. Now, from the infinity, if we take out infinity, still infinity will remain. So hypothetically it is said that actually there are many infinites, and in the sense that even if you take out many infinites from the one infinite, still infinite will remain. So in mathematics, for example, if we take the set of all numbers, it is infinite. The set of all odd numbers, that is also infinite. The set of all prime numbers, that is also infinite. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, if we go like that is infinite. 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, that is infinite. So 1, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 23, 19, these are prime numbers. These are also infinite. So now, but still, although there are infinites, we understand that the set of natural numbers is the biggest set. And then there are the set of odd numbers, the set of prime numbers. They are infinite, but they are subsets of this set. So like that, although there is infinity, there are levels within infinity, there are gradations within infinity. And even if we take out a set of all odd numbers, take out a set of all prime numbers, they remain infinite, although they remain a part of the infinite set of all natural numbers. So this is how, when we come to the mathematics of infinity, things don't remain very simple. So like that, when we talk about the absolute truth, you know, 1 minus 1 is 0, 10 minus 10 is 0, 10 million minus 10 million is 0. But infinity minus infinity is not necessarily 0. Infinity minus infinity can still be infinity. So this is how we understand the absolute truth, that the absolute truth is infinite, and although infinite universes come out from it, the Supreme Lord is called Ananta Koti Brahmana Nayak, still the absolute truth remains complete. Now, of course, no material example is complete, and it is always imperfect. And that's why when we talk about a set of natural numbers, and if you take out the odd numbers, it will appear as a set of natural numbers has become lesser. But that doesn't happen with the absolute truth, because the absolute truth is complete in fullness. So now, Srila Prabhupada, in his translation itself, often integrates his purport, because the translation is also meant to illumine concepts. So the pronoun, the adaha, which is kept ambiguous in the Sanskrit, Srila Prabhupada explains it to be the personality of Godhead. So Om Purnamadaha, the personality of Godhead is perfect and complete. So Prabhupada translates Purnaha as not just perfect, but perfect and complete. And Adaha, he translates as personality of God. I'm talking about not the word-to-word translation, but the sentence translation. Purna, Om Purnamadha Purnamidam. Purnat Purnam Udachyate. So, Prabhupada translates that Om Purnamadha Purnamidam. So, Purnamidam is, Prabhupada is almost given like a sentence translation of this. Because he is completely perfect, all emanations from him, such as this phenomenal world, are perfectly equipped as complete wholes. So, Srila Prabhupada is playing around with the word perfect and complete. First he uses completely perfect to describe the absolute truth. Then he is using perfectly equipped as complete wholes for describing the phenomenal world, which is an emanation from the Supreme Lord. So, Purnamidam, it refers to the material world. And why is it? Purnat Purnamudachyate. Whatever is produced with a complete whole is also complete in itself. Purnasya Purnamadaya. And Prabhupada is adding this point. Because he is a complete whole, then Purnasya Purnamadaya. Even though so many complete units emanate from him, Purnameva Vashishyate. He remains the complete balance. So, now Srila Prabhupada's purport is very systematic. And this is how the purport can be divided into five parts. There are five paragraphs, more or less. So, first, the Prabhupada talks about how the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the complete absolute truth. So, the absolute truth has many manifestations, as Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. So, Bhagavan is the complete manifestation of the absolute truth. That's why Bhagavan is the complete absolute truth. Then, the material world is complete. So, Om Purnamada is the first paragraph. Purnamidam, material world is complete, the second paragraph. So, we'll discuss each of these paragraphs later on. Then human form offers complete facility. That's the third paragraph. We'll see what this means and how it applies in our lives. So, beyond that, Prabhupada says that in the human form, it is a complete facility for what? Is it a complete facility for sense gratification? No. If somebody tries for sense gratification, then there is illusory completeness. We think that we'll get completeness, but we don't. And then, the last paragraph, Srila Prabhupada says that it is by devotional service that we attain real completeness. So, in this way, the concept of completeness is, in a way, perfectly and completely analyzed by Srila Prabhupada in his succinct and eloquent purport. So, as I said earlier, in the Ishopanishad, which is the Shruti, the absolute truth is not referred directly by a personal name, because the Upanishads are transitional bodies of knowledge. They are taking people from Karmakanda towards Bhakti. So in Karmakanda, all the people who are materially great or want to be materially great are talked about. So Indra, Chandra, Surya, Agni, all these devatas are glorified in the Karmakanda literature. And their worship is recommended because they are materially powerful. And Karmakandi people, those who are worshipping God for the sake of material prosperity, they want to look as ideals at those people who are materially influential and powerful. So, the Upanishads focus on rejecting material forms, rejecting everything temporary, and then taking people towards the absolute truth. But they don't focus on the absolute truth directly. Just nudge people onwards, away from matter towards spirit. So, from the Karmakanda, if you imagine Karmakanda to be the negative axis, but moving towards the positive, Jnanakanda is the neutral, zero, and Bhakti is the positive axis. So, when we are moving like this, though, in the Upanishads, the absolute truth is not directly referred to by the personal name. And Srila Prabhupada follows that strategy in his purports also. He practically never uses the word Krishna in the whole Ishopanishad. He focuses on the concept of the absolute truth. He uses the word Brahman. In fact, Prabhupada at one place, in a later purport, we'll see, he uses the word family of the Parabrahman. Normally, Brahman is thought of as to be the impersonal light. And the family of Brahman seems to be paradoxical. Because Brahman doesn't have any name, form, quality, so how does he have family? But Srila Prabhupada uses the terminology of the impersonalists to take the impersonalists beyond impersonalism. That means, the impersonalists often think that the Upanishads teach impersonalism. Impersonalism is the philosophy which says that the absolute truth is impersonal. That the absolute truth does not have form, does not have personality, does not have qualities, does not have activities. The absolute truth is pure existence, pure consciousness, with nothing else. So, for example, right now, I am speaking and you are hearing me. So, you are perceiving and I am the perceived object. So, now in this, there are three items. There are you, who are the conscious being. There is a stream of consciousness which is flowing from your eyes to the video screen. And then there is a video screen in which I am there. And I am the object of consciousness. So, there is the subject of consciousness, the conscious being. There is a stream of consciousness. And then there is the object of consciousness. And the three come together, the subject, the stream and the object. Then there is conscious experience. So according to impersonalists, the subjective consciousness and the objective consciousness, both are illusory. So you are illusory, I am illusory. So what exists only is consciousness. So this is the impersonalist idea. And they say there is no person. There is neither a perceiver nor a performer. So there is simply perception. But what is that perception? That is just consciousness. They call it as pure consciousness. Now, actually speaking, if somebody becomes liberated, there will nobody who will be conscious that I am liberated. Because there is no being who is conscious, according to their philosophy. But the impersonalists consider the absolute truth to be impersonal. So those philosophers consider that the Upanishads teach our philosophy. The Upanishads teach impersonalism. So Srila Prabhupada takes the Isha Upanishad, adopts the terminology of the impersonalists, and then takes the impersonalists beyond impersonalism. He will show how actually the Upanishads themselves take people to personal conclusions, personalist conclusions. Let's see how Srila Prabhupada does that in this purport. So now, this is an important chart. You have to understand this carefully to understand what Srila Prabhupada is saying. The absolute truth has three features: Sat, Chit and Ananda. Now, the absolute truth is always Sachidananda. But the absolute truth is not always perceived as Sachidananda. So, here Srila Prabhupada explains that when the Sat aspect of the absolute truth is perceived, then at that time the absolute truth is considered to be Brahman. What does this mean? That means that the jnanis who are perceiving the Sat aspect of the absolute truth, they recognize that this world is temporary and still I have a longing to live forever. So where does my longing come from? There must be some arena of existence where existence is eternal. And it is to that arena that I must belong. So when they think in this way, they slowly come to the level of Brahman realization. That means they understand that beyond this world, there is an eternal world. There is something eternal, not necessarily a world that they perceive. This is some kind of eternal existence is there. And they consider that to be the higher reality. In fact, the highest reality. So, at this level of perception, they have understood only the Brahman realization. Brahman platform. And the absolute truth has three aspects: Sat, Chit and Ananda. But they have perceived only the Sat aspect. Now to understand this another way, suppose, say, in a kitchen, somebody cooking gulab jamuns. Now, a gulab jamun is a sweet delicacy which is soft to touch, and if it is cooked in a particular way, it may also give a nice fragrance. So, if we have a sweet that is being cooked in the kitchen, now I am not seeing the sweet right now. But I get the fragrance. So now the sweet, so assuming that it always has the faculties of, it always has the characteristics of fragrance, taste and touch. Or let's consider fragrance, sight and taste. Three, let's see. Actually, Anandandavan Champo is a beautiful book written by Kavi Karanapur. And there he describes the glories of prasad. And he says prasad should be cooked in such a way that even before we taste prasad, it should actually captivate us in other ways. And he says this is how Radharani cooks for Krishna. When Radharani cooks food for Krishna, it's so wonderful that first that food attracts by the fragrance. Even before we see it, it starts captivating by the fragrance. Then when we go in the direction of the fragrance, we see it. And it looks so wonderful. And then when we touch it, then each item is gratifying the sense of the touch in appropriate way. So if an item is fried and it is supposed to be crisp, it is crisp. If an item is supposed to be soft and succulent, it is soft and succulent. So whatever is the appropriate tactile sensation to the touch faculty that food item should give, it gives. And then lastly, when we put it in the mouth and experience with the tongue, it gives the perfect taste. So in this way, he says that prasad should have fragrance that attracts, sight that attracts, form that attracts, then appropriate touch sensation that attracts, and finally, the taste that captivates. So out of these four, let's consider three right now. So if a delicious sweet is made, now the sweet already has fragrance, the sweet already has shape, and the sweet already has taste. All these three are simultaneously present in the sweet. But if the sweet is being cooked in another room, and I am here, so right now its taste and its sight are not accessible to me. All that is accessible is its fragrance. So, similarly, at the Brahman level of realization, now I am comparing the sweet to the absolute truth. So when the absolute truth is not yet fully perceivable to us, it is only partially perceivable. So at that time we perceive only the sat aspect, like perceiving only the fragrance of the sweet. So now it is not that Brahman is sat. Brahman is actually Sat Chit Ananda, because Brahman, Paramatma and Bhagavan are the three names for referring the absolute truth in its different features, but actually it is the same absolute truth. Vadanti tat tatva vidas tatvam yad gyanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagwaniti shadyate. So in the Bhagavatam, in the first canto, second chapter, 11th verse, divinity and divine service, when the absolute truth is defined, it is said that these three, Brahman, Paramatma and Bhagavan, they are Advaya Tattva. They are the same non-dual absolute truth. So Brahman, Paramatma and Bhagavan are the same absolute truth. So it is not, so Brahman is also Chitananda, Paramatma is also Chitananda, Bhagavan is also Chitananda. Then what is the difference between them? Actually, there is no difference from the point of view of the absolute truth. All three are the absolute truth. Just like some person may perceive the gulab jam, the sweet, by its fragrance. Some person may perceive it by its fragrance and shape. Another person may perceive it by its fragrance, shape and taste. From the gulab jamun's perspective, the gulab jamun is always the same. But from the perceiver's perspective, the gulab jamun is perceived at different levels of completeness by the three perceivers. So, what this means is that actually the absolute truth is perceived differently by different people, and when different people perceive it differently, the primary focus is on perceiving the absolute truth completely, but not everybody is able to perceive it completely. So at the jnanis, when they perceive the absolute truth, they perceive only the sat aspect. They perceive that, oh, there is some eternal existence that is there. When the transcendentalists progress further, then they perceive the chit aspect. So when they perceive the chit aspect, what happens? Sat and chit. So when they perceive sat and chit, at that time, it's like the same gulab jamun. First the fragrance was being perceived, but now the fragrance and the shape is being perceived. So the absolute truth, one has moved closer to it now. One has moved closer to it, just as one has moved closer to the gulab jamun. Is smelling it and seeing it. So the absolute truth is always Sachitananda, but at the jnani level, one has perceived only its sat aspect. At the yogi level, When one perceives Paramatma, one perceives the Chitta aspect also. What does it mean to perceive the Chitta aspect? One understands that the Super Soul is there everywhere. The Super Soul is in my heart, is in everyone's heart. And the Super Soul is conscious. It's conscious of me, of my activities. And I want to be conscious of that Super Soul. So, as I said, in Brahman realization, there is only the conception that their consciousness is all that exists. There is neither the conscious observer nor the conscious observed. Neither are there. But here, when one understands the absolute truth is Paramatma, one understands the absolute truth is being perceiving. Chakshuryasya narishyati. In the 8th canto of Bhagavatam, has described that the absolute truth's eyes never blink. Super soul is always awake, always eager, watching. Now, at this stage, one doesn't consider the super soul as the object of devotion. It's primarily the object of meditation. So, object of contemplation, admiration. And in that sense, there is devotion within that contemplation, admiration. But there is no devotion in the sense of the reciprocation of love through services and pastimes. That happens with Bhagavan. So, the bhakta perceives the absolute truth is not just eternal, is not just conscious, but is also filled with joy. And that joy is expressed through the performance of pastimes. So when the absolute truth performs pastimes, how exactly does the absolute truth perform pastimes? That is, through various dynamic activities, which are called as lila. We'll discuss the concept of lila later. But it is through the reciprocations that the absolute truth is revealed in fullness as Sat Chit Ananda. And this revelation comes to the bhakta. So, the absolute truth is in its complete manifestation Bhagavan. Because Sat Chit Ananda, all three features are realized. Without the absolute truth coming to the level of without the seeker coming to the level of realizing all the three Sat, Chit, Ananda aspects of the absolute truth, the seeker has not come to the complete realization. And that's why that realization, either if we are Brahman level or Paramatma level, is incomplete. So, when a person not only smells the gulab jamun, not only sees the gulab jamun, but then picks the gulab jamun and eats it, that is the time when the perception of the gulab jamun is complete. So like that, it's not just that one understands something eternal is there, one knows that something is conscious. No, that something is the object of love. I want to love him and he wants to love me. And we will love each other eternally in the world of endless love. That is the complete realization. So that complete realization is offered to the bhakta who focuses on Bhagavan. So in this way, Srila Prabhupada explains that in the first paragraph, the complete whole is the complete personality of Godhead. And Srila Prabhupada talks about how the complete whole is not formless. If he were formless or if he were less than his creation anyway, he would not be complete. So we will discuss this more in detail about the absolute truth having form or not having form in the later verses. But here suffice it to say that the absolute truth is complete when Satchitananda, all three features are understood. And that is understood when we focus on the Bhagavan aspect. Now the second paragraph talks about how this phenomenal world is also complete in itself. And Prabhupada says, no other unit in the universe need make an extraneous effort to try to maintain the universe. Let's try to understand what this means. So traditionally, there have been debates between the theists and the atheists. So, the theists always say that, see, there is so much right in this world, there must be God. You see, that the clouds are formed by the heat of the sun, and then the rains come, and the rains produce grains, and the rains nourish all living beings. And this whole arrangement is so majestic. How could it have come by itself? It must have come by some plan. Actually, it cannot be by itself. So therefore, the theists say that there must be a divine intelligence, there must be God. Now atheists say there is so much wrong in this world. They say if you say rains are produced by God, then, and rains are produced to nourish all living beings, then what is the need for rains on the ocean? What is the need for so much water to fall where there is already huge quantity of water? Whom is that water nourishing? So they point to the many ways in which design seems to be deficient. And they say if God has provided rains, then so many places there are droughts, so many places there are floods. Rains are too little, rains are too many. Where is the benevolent arrangement? They say so much is wrong. Where is God? So, now, actually speaking, the evidence of design is undeniable in the world. Now, clouds are so complex that they just can't be formed on their own. Now, sometimes people may say, no, it happens automatically. The sun heats and then the water goes up, and then the water goes, the water vapor. Water vapor accumulates through some natural process and then clouds are formed. However, when we say something automatically, that doesn't mean there is no existence of a designer or operator. Automatically simply means there is no awareness or there is no direct intervention of the creator and the designer. There's a very big difference between the two. That means if a toy is made in such a way that it operates automatically. So a small child normally used to watching the toys move, and the child say pushes the toy so that it moves. But somebody has made the toy automatic so that it just moves on its own. A child is surprised. So how is it moving on its own? It is moving automatically. Now automatically simply means that two things. From the observer's perspective, there is no operator seen. And from the actual toy's perspective also, there is no operator directly, constantly intervening. So there's no such thing as there being no absolutely no operator, no controller. There is a designer, there is a controller, but that control can be delegated or made in such a way that it is not required constantly, it is not visible. So similarly, the Lord has made the world in such a way that nothing extraneous is required for its maintenance. That means the Lord has made this world in such a way that once made, it will sustain itself. It will go on its own. On its own means that a man and a woman come together and produce a child. And then the child, a male and female child, they grow up, they unite and they produce children. And in this way, things go on. So actually speaking, even in managerial terms, the perfect management is that which requires minimal management or no management. Things are structured so well that they go on their own with least possible supervision. So the absence of the need of constant intervention is not indicative of the proof, is not indicative or is not a proof, not evidence that there is no intelligence. Actually, it proves that there is such a perfect intelligence that the system is designed in such a way that there is no need for constant intervention. Now, of course, the super soul is there and the super soul is constantly overseen. But the super soul doesn't have to constantly act. The super soul doesn't have to constantly intervene in the material world. The super soul has made material things in such a way that they go on by the arrangement of material nature. Prakrite kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvashah. So Krishna says in 33.27 that by the arrangement of material nature things go on. Now, of course, he also says in 9.10 in the Bhagavad Gita, maya adhyakshena prakriti, that he is supervising material nature. So in that sense, both are important. But in our context, the point which we are making over here is that nothing extraneous is required for the control, for the material world, because the Supreme Lord has so perfectly arranged, so completely arranged the material world that it is self-sustaining. Once the systems are made, the material nature's processes go on their own. Now this is with respect to the functioning. The other is with respect to the purpose. Whenever we want to evaluate a design, we have to evaluate it in connection with its purpose. Now, if I take a cell phone, now when I have a cell phone, and if I decide that I want to write a book with the cell phone, and I start typing, now I can get frustrated. I try to type over here, this is so stupid. The keys are so small, and on one key there are so many letters. How can a book be typed over here? And I can curse the maker of the cell phone. I want to write a book, and what a wretched device you have made. It is taking me 10 times more time than what is required for writing a book. Now, if there is an intelligent person around, that person will tell me, my dear friend, the cell phone is not meant for writing a book. The cell phone is primarily meant for communication through speech. And as a supplement, a facility is provided for sending some brief messages. If you want to write a book, take another device. Take a computer, type on a computer. So, if I want to evaluate how good the design of a cell phone is, I always have to keep in mind what its purpose is. If I impose my own purpose on the cell phone, my purpose is to write a book, and then I evaluate the cell phone based on my purpose of writing a book, then I can point fault with this. It's a stupid design. Why? Because the purpose of the cell phone is different from the purpose which I am putting it to use for. So the design is good if it serves the purpose for which it is meant. Same way, when we talk about the world. In the world, how good is the design, that has to be evaluated based on understanding its purpose. So if we want to say that this world is for our enjoyment, if we think that our enjoyment is the purpose of this world, then definitely we can say that this world is imperfectly designed. Why? Because there is not enough enjoyment in this world. We have a few moments of sense enjoyment that is possible with the limited capacity of the senses, and that is also for a few years, and when we grow old, we get deceased, there is no enjoyment, and then we die, and there is practically the end of all enjoyment, and there is so much suffering before death, during disease, and old age. So if I want to evaluate this world, and I assume its purpose, my purpose is to enjoy, then I assume this world's purpose is enjoyment, and evaluate it. Naturally, I will find that the world is deficient. So then what is the purpose of this world? So both the theists and the atheists have got something right. They say that, the atheists say there is so much arrangement for provision. The arrangements have been made to provide food, air, water for us in this world. The atheists say that there is so much arrangement for suffering in this world. Sometimes it's too hot, sometimes it's too cold, sometimes there's too much rain, sometimes there's too less rains. So, both are true. There is arrangement for subsistence and there is arrangement for suffering. Now, where do we see this? Are there any places in the world where both these are there? There is subsistence, there is arrangement for living, and there is also suffering over there. We see this in two places, among others. First is a jail. A jail is a place where the food, clothing, shelter, even to some extent medication of the prisoners is taken care of. At the same time, the jail is also a place of suffering. So, just because there is suffering in a jail, doesn't mean that the jail is not designed. Doesn't mean that the designer is imperfect. It simply means that the designer is designed the jail for a particular purpose. That is to punish and reform the prisoners, while at the same time providing for them. The other example, where there is arrangement for taking care and there is arrangement for suffering also, or there is presence of suffering also, that is in a hospital. In a hospital, there is everything is well planned. This is a department for this, this is a specialist doctor for this, these are the nurses who are trained in this. So there is arrangement, but at the same time, in a hospital people are suffering. So just the presence of suffering, the presence of factors which cause suffering, does not prove that there is no designer. There might be some other purpose. The hospital is meant to cure the suffering. So the scriptures explain that this world is like a prison and a hospital. It's a prison for those souls who have rebelled against God and want to enjoy separate from Him. And it's a hospital for those souls who want to rectify and heal their wrong mentality. So when we see design in connection with the purpose, then we will understand how the material world is perfect. If we see the design separate from the purpose, then we will never understand how the design is perfect. So now, let us move to the... So here is an example of perfection in design. This is remarkable. So I have given this example in my book on science and spirituality. So this is an example of a what is called as a symbiotic factory setup. So in nature we see this factory setup that there is a human body which gives out the waste product of carbon dioxide, and that waste product becomes the raw material for another factory, that is the plants. And the plants give out the waste product of oxygen, and that becomes a raw material for human beings. So this is like an industrial dream come true. Now imagine that there are two factories, factory A, factory B. So factory A normally requires some raw materials and it gives out the finished product. But along with that, it also gives waste products which has to be disposed of. But imagine if there are factory B which could use the waste products of factory A as its raw materials. And then it would give out some waste products which could be used as the raw materials for factory A again. Then what would happen is factory A and factory B would feed each other. A's waste products will be B's raw material, and B's waste products will be A's raw material. And in this way, there will be no expenditure and there will be ongoing profit. So this sort of setup is just a theory. It's not possible because the raw material, no, very few times are the waste products usable as raw materials. And most waste products are not only not usable, they are expensive to even dispose. But in nature, that which is the dream of industrialists has already been actualized. So we have plants, human beings acting as factory A, plants acting as factory B. So human beings give out the waste product of carbon dioxide, and that becomes the raw material for plants. So we see such majestic design. So we can't deny the evidence for design. At the same time, we can't deny the presence of suffering. And the material world is complete in the sense that it fulfills its purpose. It is not perfect for material enjoyment, but it is perfect for reformation, for turning towards God and returning to Him. Now, this brings us to the next point about the perfection. Srila Prabhupada, the next paragraph, talks about how human form offers us, it is the complete opportunity for realizing the completeness. So what is the human form offering? Nowadays there is a lot of talk about human rights. Now, what exactly are human rights? Because some people say that their human rights are violated. So the idea of violation of human rights is some prisoners are tortured in the prison, some people are not given even basic needs for existence, basic dignity for living, and they consider this to be a violation of human rights. Yes, certainly those things need to be provided for people, but actually these are not human rights. These are even animal rights. You know, the arrangement for food, clothing and shelter, the arrangement for food, clothing and shelter is not just the arrangement for the human beings. Animals, they have their food, they have their air, water, they have their shelter, and these are actually animal rights. So the animals get through nature these things. And providing these to human beings is not the fulfillment of human rights. So human rights are that which what none but humans can get. That is the right to enlightenment, the right to understanding the purpose of life, the right to understanding the purpose of the world and living according to that purpose. That is the actual human right, the right to enlightenment. Certainly, whatever human right violations are happening, they need to be corrected. But that is not the point. That is not what makes humans humans. You know, getting our civilization may have been arranged in such a way that what the animals get, sometimes humans don't get that. That is regrettable, definitely. But providing for that doesn't lead to the fulfillment of the actual human rights. So the real human right is the right to enlightenment. And what is that enlightenment? It is not just some flash of light rushing through the head. It is actually a coherent understanding of the purpose of life and a corresponding harmonization of our living with that purpose. That is the essence of enlightenment. So, actually speaking, it is only in the human form that we can perceive spiritual reality. In the lower forms, one cannot perceive spiritual reality. One only perceives the lower reality, the eating, sleeping, mating, defending. So that's why the human form offers us the complete opportunity to realize the absolute truth, and that's why it's considered very special. We'll discuss more about the speciality of the human form in verse in mantra 3. Here, Srila Prabhupada explained that human form offers the opportunity. In the human form, our consciousness is developed enough by which we can perceive higher realities, higher spiritual realities. We can think of things beyond eating, sleeping, mating and defending. So now, in the human form, we can attain completeness. How is that? That is our next part. So, be apart, be not apart. Be apart, that means we are meant to be a part of Krishna. Be not apart. We should not live apart from Krishna. Actually, this is based on Bhagavad Gita 15.7. Amayivamsho jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana mana shashtani indriyani prakriti sthani karshati. So, 15.7 Krishna says that Mamayivamsho jiva loke, all living beings are my part. Are they my part? So that's be apart. When we live with Krishna as His parts, playing our parts in His plan, in His service, for His pleasure, then we are happy, be apart. But if we become apart, it is be not apart, but when we become apart, then what happens? We come under the mind and senses. Mana shashtani indriyani prakriti sthani karshati. So, now, when we talk about our completeness, it is dependent. Krishna's is independent. So although we are also complete, Krishna is also complete. But there's a difference. Ours is a dependent completeness. Srila Prabhupada in the purport gives the example of a hand. So a hand is perfectly equipped to do what a hand is supposed to do. But the hand cannot do what the head is supposed to do. So if the hand is cut off from the whole body, then it cannot function. So, the hand connected to the body is be apart. And the hand cut off from the body is be apart. So, when the hand is cut off from the body, it cannot do any of the things that it is meant to do. So, similarly, when we are cut off from Krishna, we are meant to live a life of eternal happiness and love. We cannot do that when we become cut off from Krishna. So, we are also complete, being emanations from Krishna, but our completeness is dependent on our Krishna connection. Just as a hand's completeness is dependent on its connection with the body. So now, when we are in this incomplete condition right now, so we can seek completeness in two ways. One is materially and the other is spiritually. So let's look at that. Now, sense gratification promises us completeness. When a man becomes young or a woman becomes young, at that time they feel, oh, we are incomplete. We need a partner through whom we will become complete. But actually this is illusory. Because in this world we cannot become complete. Two incomplete beings cannot make each other complete. They both remain incomplete. So sense gratification keeps us incomplete. It promises us completeness, but because the pleasure is so little, it keeps us incomplete. And we keep trying in vain to fulfill the mind's foolish fantasies and draconian demands. So foolish fantasy, like a child sometimes, the mind says, I want this, I want that. If I just get this, I'll become happy. Like a child sometimes says, I want that toy. And the parents say, you already have so many toys. No, I want it, just give it to me, I'll become happy. And that child has a foolish fantasy, I'll play with this toy. And the child thinks, if I just get this toy, it'll be the perfection of my life. But after the child gets the toy, what happens? It's a foolish fantasy. After some time, the child feels like this toy doesn't matter, I want something more. And sometimes, the mind doesn't act childishly, it acts draconianly. Draconian means like a dictator. The mind makes draconian demands. You must give it to me. The mind starts tormenting us. So, we are promised completeness, but we never get completeness to sense gratification. It is a false way to completeness. So, Srila Prabhupada writes in the purport that so, the illusory representation of completeness cannot fully satisfy them. So Prabhupada writes that, then further he says, the completeness of human life can be realized only when one engages in the service of the complete whole. That brings us to the point of devotional service. There are many eloquent sentences in this purport of Srila Prabhupada. So for example, Prabhupada writes over here, because the living entity cannot enjoy the life of the senses without being totally the complete whole, the misleading life of sense enjoyment is illusion. It's illusion. It promises completeness, but it delivers perpetual incompleteness. I think if I get this new car, I'll become happy. But when I get the new car, what happens is, I'm happy for a few minutes till I see a better car. Or I till see a neighbor having a better car, which is worse. Then I want that new car and that new car. And this urge for new things just goes on and we never feel complete. So the misleading life of sense enjoyment is illusion. Now here, Srila Prabhupada explained that devotional service is what will make us complete. So how does it make us complete? By connecting us perfectly with the complete whole. That means we are tiny. We are limited. Because we are limited, if we try to enjoy on our own, we cannot get complete enjoyment. Because we are tiny, we can get only a little bit of enjoyment. But when we connect with Krishna, then because Krishna is infinite, our connection with Krishna enables us to experience infinite happiness. And in that way, by connecting with Krishna, we attain completeness. So, therefore, the way to completeness is through devotional service. When I practice devotional service, at that time, I start experiencing that here is the supreme happiness of life. Here is the way I will experience happiness forever. So, how devotional service will give us completeness will be the subject that will be discussed later in the Ishopanishad. But in principle, we cannot experience completeness because we are tiny, and no matter how many other tiny things we acquire, we will not become complete. But we connect with the infinite, and the infinite love and the infinite happiness that comes through that connection will make us completely happy. So to summarize, in this verse and purport, we discussed about firstly the mathematics, paradoxical mathematics of infinity. The absolute truth gives out many absolute units, which are many units from itself, which are complete in it themselves. At the same time, the absolute truth remains complete. Then we discussed how the complete understanding of the absolute truth is Bhagavan, the personality of Godhead. Why? Because only in the Bhagavan realization of Sat, Chit, Ananda, all three aspects are realized. So like when a sweet is pursued only through fragrance, the perception is incomplete. When a sweet is pursued through fragrance and shape, its perception is better, but not yet complete. When its perception is through fragrance, shape and taste, then it becomes complete. So similarly, our perception of the absolute truth, when it's only Sat aspect, then it is Brahman realization. Then when it's Paramatma aspect, Sat and Chit are realized, it's more complete. But when it's Bhagavan aspect, Sat, Chit and Ananda, all three are realized, then it's the most complete realization. Then we discussed about how this material world is complete. Firstly, the perfect management is that which requires no management. everything is structured in such a way that things go on their own. So that's how the material world is arranged in such a way that nature carries on its processes and things go on as if automatically. No extraneous endeavor is required. So then we discuss that automatically doesn't mean absence of a controller. Automatically simply means absence of awareness of the controller. So then we discussed after that about how the human form is complete in the sense that it offers us the opportunity for realizing eternity. So human rights are not just the rights to get the necessity that animals already get it through nature. It is the right to enlightenment. So what is that enlightenment? Not to see the purpose of the material world in our own terms for enjoyment, but to understand that it is for reformation. So the atheists say there is so much wrong in the world, theists say there is so much right. Both are correct. So the correct understanding is to see the world for its purpose, not to use a mobile for typing a book, not to use this world for enjoyment, but for reformation. And then that reformation can be done through the practice of devotional service. Sense gratification offers us false completeness. Devotional service offers us actual completeness. Thank you very much. We'll continue with this next, that is the first verse in our next class. Shri Prabhupada ki jai, Shri Shopanishad ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Nitai Gaur Premanande. Hari Hari Bo. Thank you.